Welcome back to another line with those movers and shakers, those film and TV and streaming makers, the producers, directors, writers, actors, cinematographers, production designers, costume designers, film editors, sound editors, mixers, designers, VFX gurus, composers, stuntmen and women, and so many more. And, of course, you know how much I love film, how much I love to talk about film, and how much I love to talk. So, this is why I love Mondays, because I get to talk to all of you and fill you in and showcase new films and new filmmakers. Now, we've got a new filmmaker for you today, Britt Bankhead. He is director, co-writer, producer, and lead actor. And he's talking about his narrative feature directorial debut, The Town That Takes. Now, how many of you remember some of your elementary school lessons about the early settlers of the colonies and these United States? I know I do, and so does Britt. And because of that, he is bringing us an interesting and entertaining film that blends the legend of Croatoan with a present-day mystery horror film that focuses on those 115 or so settlers in Roanoke, Virginia, who went missing in the 1500s. Now, inspired by Croatoan, the only clue left behind following the disappearance of the lost colony of Roanoke, the film transforms one of America's most enduring unsolved mysteries into a chilling blend of Southern Gothic atmosphere, investigative suspense, a whodunit, and supernatural terror, plus packed with lots of old school action. Now, for generations, historians, researchers, authors, paranormal enthusiasts have all searched for answers surrounding the disappearance of the Roanoke colonists. Now, science and documents have shown what theoretically happened, but with no definitive explanation ever discovered, the event remains one of the most debated mysteries in American history. And the only clue left behind was a single word in Algonquin, Croatoan. Now, the official synopsis for the film, The Town That Takes, is that this is the story of Dean Richardson, who is played by Britt, a troubled Army veteran living alone in Georgia who travels to North Carolina following the sudden death of his ex-wife. After the funeral, he brings his estranged 12-year-old son, Wyatt, home with him in hopes of rebuilding their fractured relationship. Their journey takes an unexpected turn when they stop in a small backwoods town haunted by whispers surrounding the mysterious word, Croatoan. Now, after encountering unsettling locals, including some creepy people in a diner, and witnessing increasingly strange events, Dean finds himself caught in a growing nightmare when a motel clerk is found brutally murdered and he becomes the prime suspect. As veteran detective Douglas O'Shea, who just transferred from Chicago, and rookie detective St. Clair investigate a series of unexplained deaths connected to the area, evidence begins pointing to something far more sinister than a simple murder case, and is somebody far more probable than poor Dean Richardson. Reports of impossible attacks, missing persons, and strange encounters spread throughout the county while Wyatt suddenly disappears. Forced into an uneasy alliance with Detective O'Shea, Dean races to find his son and uncover the truth behind the legend of Croatoan before an ancient evil claims another victim. Don't you love it when we get ancient evil? Ooh! Now, directed by Britt, The Town That Takes is written by Britt Bankhead and John Blaze, and it stars Britt Bankhead as Dean Richardson, Miles Mussenden and Grace Patterson as Detectives O'Shea and St. Clair, respectively. Nico Taurosi is young Wyatt, and he is fantastic. You may know him from other appearances that he has had in films. I think one of them was Spirit with Ryan Reynolds. And then there is Mike Markoff, who delivers a really eerie performance as fellow police officer Adams. Now, I love that, like myself, Britt first heard about the Lost Colony when he was in elementary school, and it stuck with him. leading to this project and a lot of deep research into Algonquin mythology. And also, some research into the Wendigo mythology. And a lot of you may, when you think of Wendigo, you may think of one of my favorite horror gurus, Larry Fessenden. But it's not just Britt Bankhead who's wearing multiple hats with this production. Joining him is John Blaze, who, in addition to being co-writer, is also cinematographer and editor. And as you're about to hear in this exclusive interview, Britt and I also pay great attention to composer Edward Antoine, sound mixer Landon Lipinski, and a thrill for me, stunt coordinator John Moyo, who I first met some 44 years ago, along with oodles of guys in the Stuntmen's Association at the time. John is now 87. He's still knocking him dead with old school car chases and fight scenes. He is amazing. And he truly is one of the last old timers left standing. My dear, dear friend, stuntman Neil Summers, you've heard me mention Neil over the years. Neil passed away in the fall. I think John is one of the last men standing. Bill Catching is long gone. Bill Hart is gone. Al Wyatt Jr., Neil, and so many others. But John is last man standing, and I'm tickled to see him using his expertise with this film and giving us some great old-school car chases and man-on-man fight scenes. And his son happens to be in the film also. And his daughter is also a stunt woman, just so you know. And as Britt had told me, she was supposed to be in the film, but because of scheduling conflicts, she had to bow out. But yeah, I'm tickled that I get to talk about John Moyo with this film. Now, in this exclusive conversation, Britt and I dig deep into the challenges and creative decisions of bringing this story to life, not the least of which is Britt's workload of wearing multiple hats on the project. And it comes as no surprise, Britt does admit that while rewarding, he would likely not take on so many roles simultaneously in the future due to the intense demands and lack of sleep. Yes, finally, somebody admits it. You wear all those hats, you ain't gonna sleep. Britt also reflects on the challenges of directing and acting simultaneously, the importance of trusting his team, and the need for adaptability on an indie film set. The editing process led by John Blaze was described as being collaborative and crucial to maintaining tension, especially in key scenes like a powerful interrogation sequence. And it's fantastic to have John Blaze as a cinematographer and editor because while he's shooting, he's already going to have an idea in his head of what he might need or how he may need to block or set up shots for the editing process later down the road. And we talk about scouting, location scouting, and the benefit of having an entire community on board with your film shoot, especially the police department, who allowed them to shut down intersections and perform practical stunts, including these old school car chases and fight scenes under the tutelage of John Moyo. Now, key to the film is that Britt prioritized, one of the big keys, is that Britt prioritized practical effects, including a very unique creature, and the extensive use of makeup and blood effects that really kick in those old-school 1980s slasher vibes. Another big part of our conversation deals with the collaborative relationship between Britt and John Blaze, especially in developing the film's visual style, shot list, use of negative space, going with mid-shots or shots or close-ups, but staying away from ECUs, handling the logistics of night shoots, and shooting the complex action sequences. And then there's casting. And you can tell, you'll hear it in his voice, Britt loves talking about casting and the solid cast that he's got. And as I said at the top, his two really amazing standouts for me are Miles Mussenden and Nico Taurosi. Of course, as you all know, I had to ask Brett what he learned about himself as a filmmaker in making The Town That Takes. All I will say is think perseverance, teamwork, and the importance of not overextending oneself. But the bottom line is that The Town That Takes is a strong directorial debut for Brett Bankhead. So take a listen as director, co-writer, producer, and lead actor, Brett Bankhead talks all things The Town That Takes. As director, co-writer, producer, director, co-writer, a executive producer, lead actor. You are just tackling it all here.
Yeah, I don't think I'll ever do that much again, but I was trying to save some of the budget and cut corners where I could and put it all into the movie, you know?
Yeah, well, don't feel bad. Greg Kinnear, actually, his first film, directorial, was a feature. He also starred in it, and he was in about 90% of the film, and he told me point blank, he will never do that again. Never.
What movie was that? I'm going to have to reference this.
I think it was called Phil.
Oh, okay.
He played a Greek. Absolutely adorable film. Absolutely adorable. But
yeah, I love him as an actor. He's really good.
Oh my God, he is the best. But if I recall correctly, I think the name of the film was Phil.
Okay, and I'll have to check that out.
It's been within the past, I'd say, 7-8 years.
Okay, yeah, I loved him. He got me on Stuck on You with Matt Damon.
Ah.
So yeah.
So if you don't want to star and direct and wear all the hats again, you're in good company. You're in good company.
Yeah, I heard Sylvester Stallone talk about that too, and I didn't believe him until I did it, and I was like, oh man, this is like in the middle of it. You're just like, holy crap, what have I done?
But you've got to have that holy crap experience to really understand and then say, I'm never doing that again.
Absolutely.
So you,
it's like jumping out of an airplane. You only need to do it once.
That's it. So you've done it once. Now you can focus on one or the other. You can direct or you can act.
Absolutely.
So I've always been fascinated with the legends of the Lost Colony of Roanoke, going back to when I was in elementary school. And
same.
I always thought it was really exciting. And over the years, to see what science has discovered, DNA results have found people now that allegedly have DNA that goes back to those original 115 settlers. They found logs where 50 of them, I think, or 70, took off and went to North Carolina. And then all the little islands that are out there off the coast, you know, somebody could have gone and settled there too. So I've always found it really striking. But no matter how much science or evidentiary proof comes up, the legend never dies.
Exactly. You just roll with it.
So I'm really curious, what is it that led you and your co-writer, cinematographer, and editor, John, write this particular story? This is not a typical one that you would expect.
It's not. Yeah.
Because, you know, the early settlers, I don't even know if they teach it in school anymore. But definitely not the myth of the Algonquins and the Algonquin languages. So I'm curious, what led you to the idea for this myth?
So basically, a big part of it is ADHD. Okay. So
okay.
They got my mind on it, but I had heard about Croton, and I think it was fifth grade history class, and it just kind of stuck in my head. I've always kind of like had that in the back, like what happened with all these things, and I had a script that I wasn't going to use. I've got all these scripts laying around that ADHD, like I can't help myself, and so I had this script laying around. I'm like, I'm never going to make this movie, but there's cool things in this movie that I want to do in another movie. So I give it to John. I say, hey, John, this is what I want to do. I want to do it on the Croton, and I want to adapt this script into a screenplay. So we took a lot of the characters out of that script and put it into this script. We took sequences. A lot of the story came from that, and then we started a deep dive. And John's actually the one that found all the Algonquian and the Native American lore on Wendigos. And mm-hmm. I was like, oh, that's great. That's great. I would love that, man. Because off the top of my head, I can't think of a movie like that. And I'm, you know, everybody's trying to make something original. And so we just rolled with that. And we put it together fairly quick, about a month.
Wow.
And we rolled right into pre-production.
Wow. Was it always your intent to direct and star in The Town That Takes?
I don't think it was always my intent. It was just something that I was like, I'd taken directing classes in college, and I had directed like a little short I did in 2020 during, you know, and I just thought, what a perfect opportunity to like really like get my hands dirty. And so I just dove in on it.
Well, you certainly did dive in on it, because as we break it down from a story standpoint, you have horror, you're dealing with the supernatural, lots and lots and lots of blood. It's a police whodunit murder mystery. Mm-hmm. while you're leaning into the legend, and we're thinking and we're creeped out the entire film by all of these townspeople and the people in the police department. And the person that picks up on everything to begin with is, of course, Wyatt Richardson. Leave it to the eyes of a child to see the truth of what is really going on, that there is something weird. Absolutely. And these people ain't right. So you've got all of that. Then you throw in some great action sequences, old school car chases and man-on-man fights, and I have to tell you, tickled me to no end to see that John Moyo was your stunt coordinator.
I love him.
I first met John 44 years ago.
Oh, wow.
I knew John and the other guys in the Stuntmen's Association at the time. The guy, and they were all doing Fall Guy and Johnny Dangerously and Mars Attacks, you know, big stuff. So I knew John. I haven't seen him now in about 25 years. But John,
he's still high energy.
I'll tell you. And he's 87 years old now.
I know it. You wouldn't know it.
But to see, and I was, because I'm watching the film and I see the car chases. And I see some of the great driving that's happening, especially in the first really big chase that we have, where Dean is weaving in and out, and the police car is weaving in and out behind him on a two-lane road. And the precision of that stunt, and I worked second unit on a number of things years ago. Okay. And it's not easy. It's very precise. This is when you used to use matchbox cars to plot everything out for these stunts.
Sure.
So to see that John was a stunt coordinator explained why the stunts that you have, the car chases and the fights, are very old school. They are not CGI, computerized, nothing. It tickled me, and the fact that he's still working at 87 just...
You know, his son's in the movie, too.
Yes, I know.
Yeah.
And I know his daughter is also, she's a stunt woman. I've seen her in a couple of things.
She was supposed to be in the movie. She had a scheduling conflict. And she had to fall out, but she was supposed to be in the movie, too.
Well, I got to tell you, Britt, keep it in mind for your next film that you direct. If you bring in family members, like a whole family... Like the Moyos, see if you can get a group discount. Yeah. Get a group discount rate on what you're paying them.
Yeah.
It'll help with the budgeting.
For sure.
But so you toss in stunt practicality in there that's done in camera. You've got so many moving parts here between story, character, and let's not forget... A monster in the woods. Let's not forget that either. So
we went old school with that too. The creature design for that, he did creature design on Tremors back in the day, and he was a practical effects guy, and he's just rolled with the times and the VFX. And that's where that came from. But we spent a lot of time on that monster.
It's really cool. And the way the way the scene is shot, that entire sequence, is John shot the whole thing so well. Out in the woods, the car crash, Dean crawling out of the car, calling out. And this is one of the key moments where you've got some great sound mix happening as well.
Yes.
Landon Lipinski, your sound mixer, did a great job there because you're playing with the sound. And giving us, you know, it's follow my voice. And then you're getting a responding call from Wyatt. But it's at this part, and it's at this part. So the sound is traveling throughout the entire sonic space. And it's disorienting us as much as it's disorienting Dean of, where the hell are you, kid? So your sound in there, so you've got great cinematography happening. Right after a great car chase, you've got negative space that's being brought into play. You're making use of fog and mist. And then you get a great monster creature. Everything comes together in that scene, Rick. Everything.
Yeah. I know. I really love that sequence. That whole sequence. The fog coming out under the steps. I love it. Like, all of that.
But now... For you, once you have this script in hand, and you go and you cast, and you decide you're going to direct, where do you start breaking this down that gets us to the point that we have an incredible sequence like that car crash in the middle of the night with a creature sequence?
So that was something, you know, I was in Texas, John was in California, and that was something me and John were talking about. Originally, the sequence that inspired that for me was Smokey and the Bandit. He does that great bridge jump, and John says, oh, no, I know that guy. I know the guy that did that.
He does.
Okay. So we're rolling with it, and then, you know, obviously when you're doing an indie film, you have to be very, very adaptable. So it's just kind of like, oh, well, you know, I don't think actually we're going to be able to jump this Mustang, so we need to find something else. And so we worked it to where, you know, the cops are on to him, they know his Mustang, they're looking for it, so he steals a car. So, and it was in the effect so we could roll it, basically. And, but that's how that came together. But funny story, when we were scouting locations for that, are you familiar with Sammy Maloof?
No, I'm not.
Okay, well, he's got a docuseries on Netflix. It's called Drive Fast the Maloof Way. But him and his whole family, they do stunt driving. He does it for, like, Fast and Furious movies, all sorts of stuff. But he comes in, and it's me, him, and John, and we walk into the police station, and all these cops are sitting there watching his docuseries on Netflix. And then we're like, okay, yeah, we got this. The cops turn around. They love it. They can't believe it. And they basically give us the keys to the town. They said, oh, yeah, whatever you need. So I think John was loving that. So they shut down intersection, the whole shebang. And then, you know, we're like, okay, we also want to flip some cars. Okay, man, you can do that too. So that's really how that came to be. And it was just like what we were allowed to do. We had a lot of freedom in that aspect, more than I think you normally get. I was really proud of how that turned out.
Oh, my. Where did you film this?
Texas.
In Texas? So
part of it was in part of it was in Tool, Texas, the car chase, the woods. Some of it we shot in Dallas, like the diner. It was all in Texas.
Well, and that amazes me even more because when you look at the foliage that we're seeing and the trees and the woods and all, it actually has a very East Coast vibe to the kind of trees and everything that we're seeing. Because generally that can be a dead giveaway that your location is not your location.
Yeah.
But no, so you did really well on scouting and finding that because... In seeing the wooded areas and all, it looked very East Coast.
Yeah.
So
it was great too. There was a great little lake in Tool, Texas, where those cops gave us the keys, mm-hmm. and then we found this burnt down house. And there, you know, it's on the water, so we're like, oh, what great like scenery way to switch it up. You know, we're seeing trees, we're seeing woods this whole movie, and then like boom, you're on the beach and it's water.
Mm-hmm.
And you just change it up the last shot. So, oh, I was just saying, it had a lot of great locations that we found. So.
Well, you certainly used a lot of locations here.
We did.
You really give us a great sense of the region, of the town, which is so key. Because as this plays out and your mind starts reeling and you're wondering, okay, what is Wyatt seeing that other people aren't seeing, and why is this happening, and why is it in the diner, and who is that weird waitress who keeps smiling and staring at this child? I was ready for a child abduction at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a great sequence. That's actually my sister-in-law. She was home on leave. She's in the Marines. And I said, hey, you want to be in a movie? And she was like, sure. So, yeah, we threw her in there.
See, now I hope you got a discounted rate from your sister-in-law on her salary.
Yeah, we get the family rate.
See?
So, yeah.
That's very important, the family rate.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
it is.
Once you knew that, decided that, okay, you're starring in it, you're directing this, how did you sit down and start preparing for this? Because of the fact you've got so many locations, you have quite a good number of people, a cast that you've got to work with. Granted, you've got really five primary characters. You've got yourself as Dean, you've got Miles Mussenden, who is incredible as O'Shea.
Yeah.
You've got Nico Taurasi as Wyatt, and I just think he's fantastic. I've seen him in a couple earlier films that he's done, like Spirited with Ryan Reynolds.
Yeah, such a great kid.
And he's wonderful. And then, of course, your wife, Grace, is there as Detective St. Clair. And then Mike Markoff, who exudes creep factor as Adams. So you've got all these other townsfolk and police, all these locations. You've got night shoots, you've got day, you've got the action. So how do you, putting on your director's hat first, how do you sit down and approach that? Because obviously you had a lot of conversations with John, who not only your co-writer, but your DP and your editor.
Yeah.
Walk me through that process for you of how you were shaking your head and scratching it and saying, I don't know what I'm going to do here.
I don't think I ever thought, I don't know what I'm going to do here, but I definitely, me and John were thinking a lot alike. We definitely had locations. We knew what they needed to look like. You know, as something like the motel, we wanted something old and, you know, creepy, like the 60s. That's hard to come by nowadays. So that one kind of threw us off a bit, but I mean, I think it still worked. But the diner was pretty specific, and we just went and scouted locations. It was me, him, and Grace, and we scouted until we found what we wanted. And then some of the locations we didn't find up to shooting, and we had to push those days back. And we had a locations manager that actually went out and found some of those for us later. But we got as many booked as we could before we started shooting. And then,
Now, once you had your locations, irrespective of the ones you didn't have yet, but once you had your locations, you had your cast, how did you and John Blaze, how did the two of you go about deciding on your visual grammar, how you were going to approach this from a logistic standpoint of lighting and lensing? Because that's so key. And with the amount of action and people and the locations, the type of locations you have, that can be a logistic nightmare for poor John.
Yeah.
Getting the camera in there and getting lighting, like the professor in his house, that particular sequence. It's shot through a doorway with a bunch of people. So did the two of you sit down and start shot listing, What did the two of you go through?
We talked about shots. I think we both had an idea of what each of us wanted to do. John had his kind of shot that he wanted to get in, and I had mine. As far as like complicated shots, I would say the most complicated shot that we didn't really think through was when Dean steals that 69 Corvette. And it's me and John in a Corvette, and he's trying to get footage of me. And I think, you know, we're both like fairly tall guys. And it's just we're crammed in this little car driving around. John's basically hanging out of the window. He's trying to get a shot of me. But, I mean, it looks great. I mean, that was really the one where that was a difficult shot to do. We had to, and it's a manual, too. So I'm like, I'm shifting gears at the same time. And, we were just squirming on that one.
Oh, my God. Now, you have a lot of night scenes there. Were you shooting night for night?
We were, yeah.
Oh, my. That's another fun element.
It is, yeah. Lighting nightmare.
But it really works to your advantage, especially when we're in the woods, because it gives you all this incredible negative space that John gets to play with. So,
yeah.
Similarly to Dean not knowing where the sound of Wyatt's voice is, and he can't see it because of the darkness, and instead of what traditionally might be a blue-black inkiness, this has that layer of fog. So it's a cloud that's over it as well. And that gives you really nice visual texture. But it lets him play with that negative space. So when we see a creature finally appearing, it's even creepier than usual because of that negative space and that we and Dean, we couldn't see anything.
Yeah.
So that was so beautifully shot by John.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There is cinematography was definitely on point on this. John is amazing at what he does. He's kind of like the hidden talent, you know, and I think this will show everybody like what kind of DP he can be.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like really excited for everybody to see this. But we've been complimented this whole time, looking for distribution this whole time. Everybody said the same thing. Oh, my God, the cinematography is amazing.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. But they were like, you wouldn't know it was an indie because of the cinematography. And I was like, thank you so much, you know?
Yeah, like I said earlier, you've got the cinematography, you're shooting, you've got negative space, you've got night for night. You have some extremely close quarters. A lot of close-ups, not extreme close-ups per se, but you've got a lot of close-ups, profiles, the guy in the police station, or poor Wyatt, or even Dean's face as he's smashed against the windshield of the overturned vehicle. You wear blood really well, Britt. I got to tell you, you wear blood really well.
Thank you. I think my mom would agree.
But you've got so many visual elements that you don't go into overkill. You've got things blocked out well, and your scene's structured with your characters so that you don't have an overabundance of characters in one scene. So that it's not like John's going to be fighting on what lens to use to go wide angle to get people in, because then you're also going to lose. If you and John had gone wide angle on stuff, other than some establishing shots of like the roadway with the car chases, things like that, or the hospital.
Yeah. Dean on his car.
Like, you would have lost the fear factor of the claustrophobic nature of this, of the myth, of the legend of the missing people. You lose that cloistered effect of this is a cocoon that this is happening in. It didn't happen anywhere else. It's only happening here. So you want to, you know, you really want to keep that contained, and you did a beautiful job of that, giving us a sense of time and place so that we feel like we are stuck there with all of these ghost creatures alien body snatchers, whatever we got, we're stuck there too.
Yeah.
And that's a testament. A testament to what you and John did with the visual grammar.
Yeah, we wanted it to feel very much like you are stuck here. You are not leaving, and we want you to feel what everybody's feeling, essentially, because nobody can leave. Really, they're trying to, they can't.
And then
you don't know who to trust. You know, the cops are in on it. Like, you know.
And then we have poor O'Shea. He's not trying to leave. He came there for peace after Chicago.
I know. I know it.
You have great dialogue in there for him where Adams is trying to tell him, you know, you sure, you know, you don't really get it and blah, blah, blah. And he's like, man, you know, I came from gangland, gang wars on east side, south side, Chicago. I think I can handle this. So he's, you know, he's an outsider. This town doesn't like outsiders, does it?
No, they don't. Not at all. So.
Now, how did you get into the mindset of performance? Taking off your director's hat, just talking about your performance as Dean. Granted, you draw on your own experience as an Army vet, your former infantry. So that goes a long way to your character, because that's who Dean is. He's military.
Obviously on an indie film, you're not getting like a 3-hour movie. So, I mean, everything's kind of, you need something to establish. So I think when we were developing Dean, it was kind of like, okay, well, he can't be like a banker, because like then when he starts beating up people are gonna be like, how does he know how to do that? I was just like, you know what, man, I bet if he's an Army infantry, did some deployments to Iraq, I think this guy's gonna be able to handle himself, and it's not gonna need a huge explanation on why he can do what he can do. And but I really liked the character of Dean, because I base kind of the father-son stuff off of an old movie with Sylvester Stallone. It's called Over the Top.
Love that movie.
Yeah, and that's kind of where the estranged son kind of falls in. I just always loved that, like, kind of aspect of that movie. And I wanted Dean to appear, like, you know, really cool. Like, everybody, he's got everything figured out. He's calm. He's collected. Until he's around this 12-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And when he's around this 12-year-old, I mean, he's got nothing in common with this kid. This kid's listening to weird podcasts. Dean's obviously into, like, cars, like, normal things. And, he's trying his damnedest to, like, relate to the kid, and he can't. And he's so awkward and out of place. And that was fun to play for me.
And I have to say, your chemistry with Nico is wonderful, especially in the one car chase, and we see finally Wyatt's face lights up smiling at the cool stunt car moves that Dad's doing.
Yeah, and that's kind of like their first time where he's like, okay, we found something. We got something. This is it.
Did you get any real rehearsal time, especially with Nico?
I really didn't get that much rehearsal time at all. So we kind of just rolled really quick. It was a 21-day shoot, and then we did 5 pickup days. And, it was pretty – we had a lot to cover. We didn't get a whole lot of rehearsal.
Obviously, you've got to talk to your director about allowing for rehearsal time.
I know. That guy's kind of – he's out there sometimes.
Oh, I'll tell you, you know, you really should have gone to him and said, could we have a little more time? Especially when we
I know.
Especially we get into the third act, and we're plotting and planning. We're building bombs. I like this.
Yeah.
I have to tell you, Britt, perhaps my favorite part of the whole film, and just because it's so out there. How many women can you go into their house and they have materials in there for making a bomb? I was thrilled. I was so impressed by that. And that's where you used your close-ups, is showing the meticulous nature of what Dean and O'Shea were doing, what they were building.
Yeah.
That's where you used your close-ups with nice, you know, spot lighting like you'd have at a workbench. That was a fun sequence for me. But then got a very complex scene here. You've got fire going. You've got that night scene. You've got to do a setup for an explosion. That I'm assuming, was that, did you do a practical fire and explosion, or did you do that CGI or VFX?
That was actually one of the few CGI VFX shots I did.
You know, you're not burning down any forests or starting wildfires that way, so.
Right. Yeah, we tried to keep everything as practical as we could. It was really important to me to have, like, the makeup practical. You know, the dead bodies, I wanted it practical. I wanted it to look really real and feel like you were there.
Kudos to your makeup people. Because
yeah, they were great.
The blood work, the dead bodies look great.
Mm-hmm. They did. I know that. Funny story, the gas station we use is right across the street from my wife's parents' house. And so she's going there as a kid all the time. So we kind of went in there and said, hey, you know, what do you think about us filming a movie in here? Oh, yeah. Y'all can do that. And I was like, okay. So we want to use a lot of blood. And he's like, okay, like a little on the floor. I was like a little, like, everywhere, like on the walls, the ceiling, the floors. And, I mean, God bless him, but he was so giving. And, like, oh, okay, you can tell he was kind of uncomfortable with it. But we shot that sequence from, like, 12 to 4. We had to do it when the gas station was shut down, but. Yeah, I was really proud of that. And that shot, too, I think that's, like, a really important shot for, it kind of does a lot for O'Shea. It shows you, like, hey, this guy's obviously not disturbed by this at all. He's reacting. And it also lets you know, hey, St. Clair, rookie, she cannot handle blood.
Yeah.
Right? So, I think it was very important to establish those characters pretty early on.
She couldn't handle blood in black and white, let alone in color.
Right.
Yeah, St. Clair had a problem with that. And that's one of the cool things about that whole setup in the Shell station, in the little mini mart, is that we get to see the blood. But then we get to see the surveillance tape, the grain and the black and white. So to be able as an audience to be able to see that dual perspective, that's a really nice touch that you brought in. I love that you did that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I just thought that would be, like, a really cool sequence to do. John did all the acrobatics on that as well. With the people flying through the air. And
You had really people flying everywhere, but the blood was just... How much blood did you use in this film?
We used quite a bit. I couldn't say exactly how much. I just know it was quite a bit. Oh. Our makeup expenses were quite hefty.
I was going to say, because not only do you have blood, but you have body maiming, you've got slit throats.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to account for all of the wound openings, the skin openings. The bites or whatever are on necks, but they're not vampire bites. We know what a vampire bite looks like, but no, then we've got, was it a claw? Was it whatever on bodies? So it's really, the makeup work is really well done, as is the blood.
That was really important to me. I grew up on like 80 slasher movies, so obviously that's what I was aiming for a little bit. In the makeup department, so
I think you definitely achieved that. How challenging was the casting on this one? You've got a great cast. Your principals, including yourself, of course. I don't know if I were a director, if I'd hire this guy Britt Bankhead again. I just don't know. I don't know if he's up to the task, but we'll see.
Right. Yeah. So Mike was the first one I hired for Adams, and I had seen him do a Lifetime movie with Grace a few years ago. It was called Spring Break Nightmare, and I was watching that movie, and I was like, who is this guy? And she was like, oh, that's Mike. He's like such a great guy. Like he's engaged. He's been with this girl for 7 years. He really loves her. Like he just won't shut up about his wife. And like he's such a nice guy. And I was like, we should hire him on something. And he kind of had this Patrick Swayze Point Break look in that movie. And anyway, so that was in the back of my mind. So when this came up, I was like, hey, what do you think about using Mike for Adams? You know, maybe we cut his hair. And I didn't even have to ask him to cut his hair. He did it, like, right off the bat. But, yeah, he came in, and he came in with a list of notes of things he wanted to do with it.
Oh, wow.
And it was things I hadn't thought of. I had thought of Adams in a completely different way. But he brought these notes, and I was like, well, you know, I'd have to see it. He showed me, and he's like, oh, I love that, you know. And Mike improvs a lot, too. It's sad. We had to cut some of the improv stuff, but... yeah, so Mike was a really great cast. Nico, I was scrolling through all the auditions. It was like hundreds of these like 12-year-old boys. And I was scrolling through with Grace. And I stopped and I said, this is the kid right here. And she was like, you haven't even auditioned him. Like, how do you know? I'm telling you, I got a feeling this is the kid. And she's like, well, like, let's audition some other people. And I was like, yeah, absolutely, but I'm telling you, this is the kid. And sure enough, it was the kid. So we hired him. And then Miles is with the same manager as Grace. And so we had an in. Mm-hmm. But I had seen Miles on Tulsa King. And I was telling Grace, I said, hey, this guy's really good. Like, you should see it. And, yeah, so next thing you know, we're binging Tulsa King. And, Miles came on and... we took a meeting with him. He really loved the script. And, he's a big fan of indies, too. So
that's important. When you're casting an indie film, you really want actors who aren't just taking it just to have a job. But they really do believe in the indie film process. Because that way, when they're not getting five-star hotel catering every day for lunch... they're happy to just have 7-Eleven hot dogs. So they're not expecting more than that. It's all about the work. It's all about the film and making the story as good as it can be. And you definitely got that from your actors. Definitely got that from your actors here.
Yeah.
And as I said, I just love Miles as O'Shea.
Yeah.
And then to see your chemistry develop with him... get to that hour mark and there's a total shift, and to watch the two of you, it starts out rather reluctantly, but then it's like, no, we're on the same page here. Of course.
Yeah.
They're both outsiders.
Yeah. I kind of envisioned, these two characters from like Martin Riggs and Murtaugh from Lethal Weapon.
Yeah.
That's kind of how I thought about it when we were putting them together. And I really like Miles, too. Like, he's so easy to get along with. So it was very natural and organic.
But I love seeing the two of you on screen together. I love seeing you when you're sitting at the desk and he's just casually asking you questions. You're detained, but you're not arrested.
Yeah.
Then when you're being interrogated after being arrested, and then when you finally, we see this whole change in the dynamic of the two of Dean and O'Shea. And it's wonderful to watch. You really have that developed completely in this film. And it's refreshing to see a relationship like that go from such adversarial position into something that good. It's just wonderful. Now, once you get everything shot, your 21 days are done, your 5 pickup days are done, you haven't pulled all your hair out, then you got to go into the editing bay with John Blaze.
Yeah.
Now, was John doing any editing while shooting so that you would have...
He was.
Okay, so you were getting to see dailies and maybe rough edits...
Mm-hmm. I think the sequence that everybody, I think Miles even came to me with concerns about the interrogation scene, because, I mean, it is a long scene. I think it's almost 10 minutes. And how are y'all going to shoot this and keep it, like, moving, the tension? And John did a really great job with the camera sweeps. The camera's constantly moving. And then just when you think you've seen everything, now you've got Adams. Adams is peering in. What's this guy thinking? You know? But I really felt like there was a shift. And that's why that seems like so important to me. I wanted to see the shift of O'Shea being like, okay, nothing else makes sense. I have no other choice but to trust this guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was the sequence. But John went and cut that the next day. He came to me. Hey, check this out. Oh, okay. So it's like me and Miles are like crowded around like it was his first cut. And I think there was a lot of relief after we saw just a rough cut of that scene. So I was like, oh, okay, this is going to work.
I love that scene.
I do too.
It's
one of my favorite in the movie.
It's very intense. You feel the tension.
Yeah.
But you also see the shift, the tonal shift in O'Shea. You see that, you feel it and you see it. You know, when he gets his spiel out and says, okay, your turn, you talk. Then Dean talks and you see John shot this so well that he then had the footage he needed to maintain tension, but change up and give us different POVs. So people didn't get bored. So this came in really handy for you, having John as DP and as an editor.
It did, yeah. It did. It was that, and then, you know, Grace is really good about, she'll pull me to the side very discreetly and say, hey, why don't you do this? And I'll say, okay, I'll try that. And then we'll do the scene. And then I see her behind the monitor with a big grin on her face, like two thumbs up, like, good job! I had my wife, a little bit of a co-director.
You know, how difficult was it for you wearing the director's hat and the acting hat at the same time? Did you have problems taking off the director's hat and just being Dean, actor Dean, and vice versa? As Dean, did you think, oh no, we really need to change this up? The director Britt infiltrates the brain. So how challenging was that for you?
I didn't feel like it was really challenging to pop in and out of character. It is, I will say, uncomfortable at first, because I think everybody's like, oh yeah, I can direct and act. And I will say the first couple of days I was really like kind of struggling a bit, because you can't direct yourself. I mean, you really have to trust your footage, and you can't even always go look at your footage, because sometimes you're on such a tight shooting schedule that you can't even look at what you just shot. So you just have to like trust that you did the right thing and you prepped well enough as an actor to do that. And the same as directing, you just have to hope that all the prep paid off and that you can fully pull those two off. And I don't think I'll ever do both of those again. It's quite challenging.
Did you ever think, while you were acting, did you ever stop and think, did the director Britt intrude your brain and think, God, I hope that I'm framed good and look good in this shot?
You know, honestly, that was the last thing on my mind. I don't really concern myself with that stuff. I've seen, you know, you see some actors and they'll die, but they'll die to where they look good or something like that. And it never really comes into my mind about how I look. It's just, how convincing can it be? Like, how in the moment am I as an actor? So
I can't imagine you just jockeying, because of the very nature of this film and all the action work and the intensity. It just had to, your head must wanted to explode at certain moments as director Britt was fighting with, you know, actor Britt in certain moments.
Yeah, we didn't sleep a lot. I didn't sleep a whole lot during this shoot either. I was probably sleeping like 3 hours a night. I mean, you wrap your day and then you're rolling into like producer stuff. So it's like, a lot of nights. I was emailing back and forth with SAG and getting them documentation that they needed for whatever it was, and it's just it felt like a nonstop roller coaster for me. And I've never been so relieved to wrap anything in my life. I was just like, oh, thank God, it's over.
So what's more difficult, acting and directing and being a producer on and writing, co-writing a film like The Town That Takes, or executing a military maneuver? Or are they pretty similar?
I would say, in my opinion, it's pretty similar. It's prep time, obviously. It's good communication. It's working with a team. I would say they're pretty similar. They're just different things.
Mm-hmm. Now,
so, you always go on with the plan.
Curious about your score, because you paid such attention to the story, to your characters, to the cinematography, to your action. What were you looking for musically from your composer to buttress the different aspects of this film?
Edward is really great. I've been friends with Edward for a long time. He's really great. I don't really have to do a whole lot with him. The hardest part I do find in indie filmmaking is music, though, because, for instance, when I write scripts, I write camera shots I want in there, and I write music in there that I want. That kind of sets the tone of what it feels like, and that just kind of helps me describe to people, you know, like the vibe of the shot I want. And so I think in this one, I had written Nirvana, Something in the Way. That was supposed to be, that was the song of the movie. And then, of course, you know, such heartbreak when you get to post-production. And yeah, it's just kind of out of your reach. So, I would say music is really heartbreak on that. But I think we ended up with pretty good music. For my friend Jacob and Jarrett, they put together some songs. They did I wanted Greta Van Fleet for the chase scene, and we couldn't get that either, so they put together like the chase music for mm-hmm. that scene, and we did some rough drafts with that and went back and forth, and we spent a lot of time on music too. So
yeah,
and then they did that beautiful cover of just went blank. The Animals.
Yep. Opening title, end title. That cover is just, it's wonderful. It's beautifully done.
Yeah.
And it's creepily done, too.
Thanks, yeah.
You,
that was the goal.
Yeah, you got that. Did you shot list and storyboard, or just shot list or storyboard for this? Because you have so much action in here, I'm thinking maybe you had to storyboard some stuff. But tell me, what route did you choose?
So basically, we thought we had everything pretty planned with a shot list and how we were going to do things. And then we get to, for instance, the police station, and we get there the day of, and, you know, John Wells tell me, this isn't going to work, da 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 da. And I said, oh, why not? He's like, you got to keep it compelling, you got to do this, you got to do that. And I was like, okay, well, what do you want to do? So he put together that whole fight scene right there on the spot, and that's kind of what we did. And it was so on the spot, and you know, I think I didn't have a hard time letting that go. I think, but because it turned out so great, and it's a beautiful shot. I think so. John does great at all that he does. So.
Oh my God! So now that you have made it through your first narrative feature directorial, what did you learn about yourself as a filmmaker that you can take forward into future projects and hopefully get some of those other scripts of yours lying around done?
I think there's like a lot of perseverance in making film that you just get through naturally. But I think when you layer on like multiple hats, it's just like, okay, for instance, I can see where I kind of fell short on some things, in my opinion. And, like, I just know now not to wear so many hats, because I might fall fell short over here somewhere, because it really did feel, when we were making this, it felt like a human game, a tug of war, and everybody needed me in different spots. And I couldn't be everywhere at once. I'm one man. So, but yeah, I think that would be less hats.
I think you juggled the hats you were wearing quite well. You have, Thank you. From the story itself, I mean, the fact that you and John Blaze, you tapped into this legend and you built upon that and brought in so many other elements that work and play upon that legend. It all started there and you just built on that and you did a really, really good job, Britt.
Oh, thank you so much. That's comforting to hear.
Of course, you hired Moyo. You can never go wrong if you hire John Moyo to do your stunts.
Yeah, he's great.
That's the best endorsement I'll ever give John Moyo. So
that's hilarious. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting when he's on set too, because I mean, like, you're sitting there. I don't think people realize how far it goes back. And then next thing you know, he's telling me about these prank wars he used to have with Elvis. And I'm like, what?
Yeah.
You're friends with Elvis? And he's like, yeah. This one time with Steve McQueen. I was like, what?
Yep.
So, yeah, he's got a lot of cool stories.
And a lot of cool experience that goes with them.
Absolutely.
But on every level, Britt, you did such a good job. I hope you're going to direct again.
Yes, ma'am. I think I will.
Do you have anything in the pipeline, or is it just getting this film out now?
I do have, I'm in pre-production for a film. My older brother was killed in Iraq in 2007, and there's a film about that I've been working on since 2020, and it looks like it's coming to fruition.
And you'll be helming that.
Excited about it.
And you'll be directing that one?
Yes.
Well, I can't wait to see it. This is a this is a great calling card. A great calling card for you as a director, Britt.
Thank you so much.
And hopefully I'm going to get to chat with you again in the future about more work.
Oh, absolutely.
This has been so wonderful getting to speak with you about The Town That Takes, and this is one instance where The Town That Takes also gave you a great story to tell and a really good film for us to see. So, job well done. Job well done.
Thank you.
Well, you go have a great rest of your day, rest of interviews, whatever the heck Annie is doing to you. And hopefully we will chat sooner rather than later.
Absolutely. You have a great day as well. It was wonderful chatting with you.
Oh, thanks so much, Britt. And that was Britt Bankhead talking all about The Town That Takes, which you can see right now on the big screen in select theaters. Unfortunately, I don't have a list of those select theaters, so check online if you have a newspaper. Look in your newspaper under your theater listings. But that is all the time we have today. Of course, we ran long. It was a very long interview. Just shy of an hour, and then I had to prattle my mouth to you for a while. So we're out of time, and then some. But make sure, check out BehindTheLensOnline.net for more movie reviews and interviews. A ton of them have popped up. Amazing, isn't it? Including a film from Eli Roth called Death Boom. It is a documentary currently on the festival circuit. You don't want to miss this one. It's great. And I had so much fun doing the review for it. Another film on the festival circuit you want to keep your eye out for. Was it The Last Place on Earth? It is exquisite. It won the Grand Jury Prize for Documentaries at Dances with Films just a couple of weeks ago. And a bunch of interviews there, including Phil Byron talking about his directorial debut with Spin Wars. For those of you that are into spin cycling, this is a hoot and a holler, let me tell you. And of course, Daniel Stamm's interview is up for Lockbox, along with the review on the film. So check it out. I got a lot of new stuff up there for you, and more that's coming. There's always more coming. So there is something for everyone. So until next week, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.